Now we both kinda like it. Now we both kinda know that if we're ever gonna make it, we just need to let go.
You're listening to the Crosscutting Concerns podcast. I'm your host, Matt Groves. Please visit the site at crosscuttingconcerns.com, where you can subscribe, browse the archives, contact me, read show notes, and leave a comment. I'm recording this podcast on November 15th, 2016. My guest today is not a developer, but he has done pretty much everything else, including PM, BA, QA, writing screenplays, and performing stand-up comedy. Matt Bach, how are you?
I'm doing good. How about yourself?
Doing great. We had so much fun talking about retro games back in episode 16. I wanted to have you on again, especially since it's almost Christmas time and there are some great retro gaming products coming out. And we're going to talk about at least two of them today. And let's start with one that you're really interested in, the Atari Flashback Portable.
Just to kind of preface this with my background so it makes a little bit more sense in context.
Sure.
I'm 44. My childhood high school was kind of the Atari 2600 salad days, if you will. And I actually had what was called a Studio 2 first. That was my first home system. And it was pretty much almost just like a Pong type thing. Some of my friends had a 2600 and some of my friends had an Intellivision. But the 2600, not necessarily because of the gaming quality or the graphics or the sound, but just the prevalence of how many people had them and the number of games available. And I remember you could buy 2600 games, like knockoff type games, in the grocery store. It was everywhere. Over the last couple of years, I think they're on the Flashback 7 or the Flashback 8, which is just a type plug-in type system. Those have all been okay. I have one or two of those, but it suffers a lot of the problems that some emulation systems have in that it's not using the true chipset and some of the sounds are off. But more importantly, the game selection is limited to whatever is out of the box. And it's usually, I think the first one had 30. Now they're up to like 80 on some of them. And I had a pretty substantial 2600 collection back in the day, probably over 100 individual carts. And a lot of them are ones that were never popular enough to kind of make the grade or make the cut to show up on any of these systems.
True.
And a couple of years ago, there was I don't know if you've ever heard of a guy, his name's Ben Heck. He does a lot of console modifications, and he will take a Xbox 360 and he'll put it in a laptop case and things like that. And over the course of years, he's made several 2600 portable systems that he basically took a 2600 apart, cobbled the chips together, used a LCD screen from a PS1, and he made these custom CNC devices that were pretty cool, but they were all one-offs and they weren't available. And even if he would sell one to you, they were going to cost $500-$600. And over the course of time, there's been things like the PSP or the DS or the 3DS or the 3DS XL, and all of them had carts available for them that had 5 Atari games or 10 Atari games or whatever it was, but there was never a true Atari portable system. And a couple of years ago, there was a prototype leaked, which is not actually the same one that's being released, but it was similar. And I was like, you know, this is something that I would have to have. This is something that, for me, this is right in my wheelhouse. And one of the things that I look at 2600 games as, I kind of compare them to apps for your phone, whether that be an iPhone or an Android or a Windows phone, you know, for those 5 games available for a Windows phone. But they're games that are consumable in small chunks of time. I mean, you can sit down and you can play a game of whatever, Adventure, for example, on the 2600. You play the entire game, it might take you 10 minutes, but it is a complete experience. And the 2600 has always just been a very nostalgic thing for me because it was from my childhood. So when I saw that At Games or AT Games, I don't know how it's pronounced, was actually going to release one, I thought, wow, this is cool. This is something I'm going to have to get if I can ever find one and they actually do release it, because I don't think it's out yet, but it's supposed to be out in November.
Right, so definitely check out atgames.net. I'll put a link in the show notes. There's no price on the site for this device yet. It's probably going to be mostly sold in stores at retail, so the price is going to vary based on where you buy it and what time of year you're buying it. So I want to talk about games a little bit. The Flashback Portable is listed 60 games on there, and these are the same staple games that have been in the other Flashbacks, but I think there's one new game this year, which is Frogger.
Right.
And that's definitely going to move some systems. That's a very popular game for a lot of reasons, you know, one of them being the Seinfeld episode, of course. But your kids are probably going to think of it as blocky version of Crossy Road, even blockier version, right?
Yeah, and that kind of goes along with the whole thing I was talking about with how these are almost like app games. They're like the $2 games you can get at the Apple Store.
Just I'm not going to list all the games here, but there's a few on here that I think are notable, and maybe you can comment on them. The first one is Tempest. Now, I didn't play Tempest in the arcades, so I was probably too young for the so-called salad days of the Atari. I'm more of an NES child, but I did play, this is pretty obscure, but Tempest 2000 was on the Atari Jaguar. I played that first, before the original Tempest, and that is an amazing game, by the way, Tempest 2000. If you have a chance to play that, I don't think it's ever been released somewhere else. That really got me interested in the original Tempest.
Yeah, so Tempest is back in, you know, going back to the arcade version of it, there were generally two different types of games. There were games that used vector graphics,
sure,
and then games that used just like regular, I think they're called raster graphics, which is just your regular TV, the difference being the way that the actual picture is painted on the screen. And Tempest, much like Defender and Asteroids and the original Star Wars arcade, were those vector type graphics, also was somewhat unique in that it was one of the first, if not the first, arcade games that used a spinner rather than a joystick, and it did have buttons. The Jaguar, interesting system, didn't really sell a lot. It was kind of here and gone really quick. I've never actually played a Jaguar. It's one of the few systems I've never actually laid my hands on and played. It is interesting that, you know, when you look at the list of games, and I know we're going to go through some of these, it's interesting the ones that are on there, and it's also interesting the ones that are not on there.
Yeah. One of the things you mentioned is the Atari library is really massive. There are so many games, because everyone was getting in the game business back then. I mean, there was like a Kool-Aid game, for instance.
Yep.
You know, I think probably something has to do with licensing. They can't get these games to resell them. But there's a couple games on there that are noteworthy by their absence, and that is E.T. and Pac-Man, which are two infamous games. Maybe you want to talk about that?
So E.T., and I don't know if you've seen it, there's actually a really, really good documentary about...
Oh, yes. This is on Netflix, I think.
Yes, it is.
It's a great one.
It's not so much about the E.T. game as it is about the fact that the E.T. game, or the millions of cartridges of the E.T. game... Urban legend held it that they were actually buried in a landfill in New Mexico.
Right.
And someone somehow...
Don't spoil the documentary.
Yeah. found out where they might be, and they made a documentary about the search for the actual things in the landfill. And there is a really interesting story just behind the whole story of the E.T. cartridge. And I know that you're going to talk about it later, but Yar's Revenge is another one, another game that is on this system, which is... generally considered, rightly or wrongly, one of the stars of the 2600 lineup. The programmer who programmed E.T. is the same guy who programmed Yar's Revenge. That kind of begs the question, how can somebody create the pinnacle of what can be done on a system and also release what is generally or widely considered to be one of the worst games ever for a system?
Right. I've played E.T. recently. I did a whole Twitch cast on it. In fact, once you understand how it works, mm-hmm. and if you have read the manual, it's really not that terrible of a game. I mean, there's a few glitchy things in it, but considering that it was coded in, what, like 6 weeks by one guy, it's a pretty amazing piece of software.
Right, and the thing about that is, and you hit right on it, it was coded in an extremely short period of time to meet a release window.
Right.
And as you and I both work in software in different capacities, we're well aware of some of the sacrifices that get made from time to time in order to meet what sometimes are extremely arbitrary deadlines. this was not an arbitrary deadline because this was a seasonal thing. I think they wanted to make sure that it was in stores for Christmas. He did the best job that he could with it. There's actually a ROM hack out there for ET, and the only difference between the actual cart version and the hack version is that some of the more glaring glitches or collision detection or problems, especially with falling in the holes, if you're off just that much, have been fixed, and it makes it a better game. And it's not that it was a bad game to start with, it's just that there were some control issues and some programmatic issues that didn't get fixed. One of the things about ET, and I relate it to another 2600 game, which is not on this list, and it's not on this list for a reason that we'll get into, is Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And I don't know if you've ever played that on the 2600. It's a complex game. It's not a simple game, and it requires you to actually, you know, read the manual and understand what it is. But once you understand it, it actually is a complex, and actually it's a pretty good game. The reason it's not on the flashback, probably other than licensing issues, because I imagine that would be a big one, it is one of probably maybe four or five carts in the entire 2600 library that requires two joysticks.
Ah.
And that is actually one of the things about the flashback I don't like. There are a couple things about it I really do like from what I know about it. One of the things I don't like about it is there's no ability to connect a second controller. So any games that require two players or require two controllers can't be played on it. And one of the things that we haven't mentioned is that there is an SD slot on this portable unit.
Yeah.
And if you have the ROM files for these, I think they're A26 format, .A26, if I recall correctly, you actually will be able to play the rest of the games in the 2600 library, with the exception of there's like three carts that can't be played because they have special chips inside the cartridge themselves, one of them being Pitfall 2, which is actually a really, really good 2600 game. I remember when Pac-Man came out for the 2600 because it was a huge deal, because Pac-Man was a cultural phenomenon at the time. There was, what was The Odyssey? I don't know if you've ever seen or heard of The Odyssey.
From Magnavox, yeah.
They had a game for that, I believe it was called Munchman. And every system had some kind of Pac-Man clone or ripoff. And the 2600 version, for all of the flack that it gets, is not a bad game. When you compare it to the 2600 of Ms. Pac-Man, it is a bad game just because it's not nearly as close to like a true arcade port. But for the time, for the replayability, it's not a bad game at all.
We talked about this in the last episode, but check out the book Racing the Beam just to see what kind of technical constraints that these guys were up against. It was amazing that Pac-Man got made at all.
No, and you know, we live in a world where you have the ability to literally have as much code as you want. When you're working on a project, especially if you're working on a project in a run space, one of the hardest things to do, but one of the most important things to do, is to work on technical debt, because you have so much, or doing refactoring, which are not sexy because it's not something that's easy to sell to a client, because there's not a lot of pop that they're necessarily getting for it. When these people were programming for the 2600, they were dealing with 2K or 4K of memory to make an inclusive experience. And the fact that they were able to do anything with that, already this podcast is 150 times larger than the Atari 2600 library.
Easily. Just speaking of technical achievements, there's a game, a little-known game for Atari, called Secret Quest, and I think it's on the flashback. This is a kind of a weird game. It was supposedly Atari's response to The Legend of Zelda, which seems kind of anachronous, right, that they existed at the same time. But the Secret Quest game is maybe the most technically impressive 2600 game. It has background music, large maps, and, you know, halfway decent graphics. And I don't know if you've ever played it before, but it's definitely surprising to see this on the Atari 2600.
I've seen a lot of the different homebrews that, because there is still a market out there, or I wouldn't say market, but if you go to any of these collector shows, and they have one in Columbus once a year, I think it's called Korgs. Columbus, I don't know, it's called Korgs, but I don't know what it actually stands for. And they have a show every year where people come out and vendors are selling various old games, systems, going all the way back to the beginning, all the way up to current games, to Xbox One, PS4 games. There's always people who have homebrew carts, and there are people that have actually programmed new games for the 2600, burned the ROM onto a chip, created custom artwork for them, and they look just like original 2600 games. And this, the game you were talking about, I am actually really curious to check that out, because that's one of the few I have never played before. So I'd love to see it, especially, it always amazes me when you see how far they're able to push the system. And there are, we'll get to the NES later, but you'll talk about different things that are kind of like game changers, things that change the way that you look at it. I know it's not the most graphically advanced game, but one of my favorites that it would be amazing if it wasn't included is Adventure.
Yeah.
And, you know, Adventure is one of those games where, you know, I know the maps by heart. I know all the mazes. They're not that complex, but it was one of the first games that had a beginning, a middle, and an end. The fact that it was randomized, you didn't know where the sword was, where the bridge was, where the magnet was, where the keys were, where the chalice was. The fact that it was a different game each time was so amazing at the time, and unlike anything else that I can think of that came before it. That would be what I would consider to be like the precursor to a game like The Legend of Zelda, obviously on a much different scale. But still, just the way that they did it, plus there's the whole dragon thing. You know, what's the strong bad thing about duck?
Yeah, it's like a duck, yeah. Yeah, so Adventure is a very famous game for Atari, and it is a game changer because it's one of those games like Yar's Revenge that was not based on an arcade machine coming to your house. It was made just for the home console. You know, it does have some questionably strange graphics like the duck, but it is a very innovative title, and it takes you beyond that single-screen arcade experience.
And I believe it's actually the first Atari game or home system game that has an Easter egg in it.
Ah, yeah. It may be the first in history. Yeah. They say that they didn't like to give programmers credit in the games, maybe for business reasons and maybe for technical reasons, but this is one where he actually hid his name in the game. Is that correct?
Yeah, there's a thing. It was called the hidden dot or the magic dot. It actually, if you had that dot, you could go through one part of one screen to a secret screen, and it had a scroll, or not a scroll, but it had a wall of text that said, created by Warren Robinette, who is the creator of it. And at the time, Atari, like you said, did not give credit to the programmers for their games. And that was one of the big things about Activision that was very different at that time, because like David Crane and several other people came out of the Activision area, and front and center on the boxes, it said who the developers were, which was a big difference.
So just one more thing, the Atari flashback flyer, it shows a screenshot of a game called Jungle Hunt, which I'm sure you're familiar
yes.
with. But Jungle Hunt is not in the list of the games. So they also call out the SD card slot. But they, in the flyer anyway, they do not specifically say you can load ROMs onto the game. So I'm pretty sure it's a wink, like wink, wink, you can put games on this if you want to. But speaking of Jungle Hunt, it's kind of like Pitfall, which is an Activision game. Not on this flashback, which has got to be for licensing reasons, but it's a very decent, Jungle Hunt's a very decent platformer, and it has the cool parallax scrolling effect, mm-hmm. which you don't see on the older games too often. But I want to get to just wrap this up here. Would you recommend the Flashback Portable? I know it hasn't been released, you haven't played it yet, but would you recommend picking it
absolutely.
Up?
Absolutely. This one is a no-brainer for me. There's absolutely, for me, I mean, I can't speak to the whims and wills of other people, but this is something I'm definitely going to get. And for anybody that kind of grew up in that and has that history of playing those games, It's definitely good. My kids have actually showed an interest in playing 2600 games when I've hooked up 2600s around here. And just as a last thing, I know that it's not out. I do have the Sega Genesis equivalent of the same handheld. I can speak to the build quality is decent. It's very light. It's very small. It's very light. It doesn't have a lot of heft, but it plays very solidly. And battery life, I found to be about 4 hours. So it's not great, but it's not terrible.
That's not bad. Yeah, that's the only thing I'm concerned about is the game lineup is going to be great and the software is fine, but the buttons are made, you know, they're shoddy and they don't work that well. I mean, the original Atari controller, it was not great to begin with. But that being said, these guys have a good track record. They've been around for a long time, so I think it's probably going to be okay.
Okay, now moving on to the big daddy, right?
Okay, yeah, let's switch over to the NES Classic. If you grew up in the salad days of Atari, I grew up in the salad days of the NES, and this thing just hit the market, and it's already been sold out, and, you know, I don't know if there's going to be more devices being shipped or not, but it's already a really hot item for this Christmas.
I can actually speak to that a little bit. I have done a little bit of research into it just because I have not been able to find one yet. I have played one, but I have not been able to find one yet. I've been told that that will be shipped before Christmas. I'm really surprised that Thanksgiving and Black Friday coming up very shortly. I think it speaks to there's going to be a lot of things I'm going to have to say about this particular system. There's so many things that Nintendo got right, but at the same time, there's so many things that Nintendo got wrong.
just to give you an overview, this is $59.99. It's a plug-in version, like the Atari Flashback, kind of, that comes preloaded with games. Unlike the Flashback, you can plug in a second controller, which is a cool feature.
Yes.
Does not come with a second controller, so you probably should pick one up if you want to play two-player games. And these controllers can also be plugged into the Wii or the Wii U. So if you have that, it's already a pretty good value at that price, I'd say.
And you can use if you have a Wii or a Wii U currently, and you have the Wii U or the Wii Classic controller, which looks very similar to a Super Nintendo controller, that also will work with this system.
Oh, that's good to know, because I have one of those, so maybe I won't buy the second controller. But they are the cool retro-style controllers, so I kind of dislike them, the look of them in general, so I may pick one up. There's a list of games. Again, we're not going to list all of them, but I wanted to just maybe list some of the notable ones, and maybe you can bring up some that you're interested in here. The first one I saw, and when I first saw this list of games, this was released a few months back, I think, as a preview. I saw this game on the list, and I knew right away that this thing's going to sell like hotcakes, and it's going to be a hard-to-find Christmas gift. And can you guess what that game is?
Based on Kia commercials, I'd say probably Tecmo Bowl.
Yes, Tecmo Bowl. So the sports game market is massive, and there are lots of people who grew up in the NES era who love Tecmo Bowl. You know, even if they've grown beyond hardcore gaming and retro gaming, they're still going to want to play Tecmo Bowl. So that's why I think this system is a guaranteed home run for Nintendo.
One of the things that'll be interesting to see, I don't know this because I've not played this particular game on the system, is which version of Tecmo Bowl is this going to be? And when I say that, I don't mean is this going to be Super Tecmo Bowl or Tecmo Bowl. If you bought Tecmo Bowl for the Virtual Console, for the Wii or the Wii U, it was different just because of licensing issues in that it did not have all the player names that the original Tecmo Bowl had.
Right. So back then it was probably either they got the licensing or they just didn't care about the licensing and they released it with the names?
I'm assuming. I think it has an NFLPA emblem on it, so I believe they had the licensing at the time.
Yeah, well, hopefully they'll have at least Bo Jackson, right? He's the one in the commercials. So that's the one people care about, I think, most.
No, I live in a DVR world where commercials are very seldom seen. The idea of live TV out of sports itself is very, very rare. I had a TV on, and I don't know if I was doing dishes, but I was somewhere away from the TV, and I heard the Tecmo Bowl theme, and it's something that I've heard so many hundreds of times that it's ingrained. I'm like, where would the Tecmo Bowl theme be coming from? And I saw the Kia commercial. It's incredibly clever marketing. not just for using the Tecmo Bowl brand, but also for the fact that they have Bo Jackson there. And for anybody who has played Tecmo Bowl knows about Bo Jackson. And,
right.
And then also, I can't remember the other guy, the blonde guy who played for the Seahawks, who's also now shown up in the same commercials. They're being very clever and they're appealing to a certain marketing demographic, which I know that you and I probably both solidly fall into. But Tecmo Bowl definitely is one of the things that I think will shift quite a few units for this if they weren't going to sell already, because as you said, it's hard to find.
Right. I didn't even play Tecmo Bowl much as a kid, but all my friends who were really into sports games, I mean, this is the game, if you say, you know, Nintendo, they'll say, oh yeah, I love Tecmo Bowl. So this is the game that will even take the most non-gamer and turn them into a nostalgic gamer. So I think it's definitely a sweet move for them to put that on the system. My favorite game of all time, however, all across every system, including NES, is on this console as well. Mega Man 2, and I believe this is one of the best games of all time. Not a perfect game, but near perfect, and like I said, my favorite game of all time. Are you familiar with Mega Man 2?
Yeah, I don't know the Mega Mans individually, because I've played them all. I don't remember which one is which one has Snake Man, which one has Iceman, but they were all really good, and I it was one of the first games that gave you the ability to play the game differently, because if I remember correctly, and I think this started with the first one, but might have started with the second one, you can actually choose which guy you're going to fight, which boss right. you're going after. As you play the game, you realize, well, Iceman is vulnerable to fire, so you need to get Fireman, and these are just examples, I don't know if they're actually correct,
right.
You have to kill Fireman first, and then you go after Iceman. It was interesting because there's different ways that you can kind of go about the game, and it kind of alters the challenge level. And Mega Man has actually had somewhat of a resurgence in the last couple of years. I mean, on and off,
right.
There have been like the Mega Man X series for various consoles, and then, you know, the Rockman series in Japan. They have actually released not only all of the Mega Man series as downloadable content to the current systems, they also have released, I think it's called, I want to say called Mega Man 7, but it's actually a brand new version, well, it was new 2 years ago, of the Mega Man series in the 8-bit look. Incredibly hard game. The Mega Man one, it's like, I think that they could put all the Mega Mans on here. I can't, like I said, I can't speak to which one is which, because I don't remember which ones are which, but it is definitely one of those things that it would be a glaring omission if it wasn't there.
Mega Man 2 is the only one on the system right now. I think it's the best of the series. I'm sure people will vehemently disagree with me. All of them, you could choose which level to go to. That was sort of the defining characteristic of Mega Man, and you could get the weapons and use them against the bosses. And this is a game that I actually asked for Mega Man 1 for Christmas, and my parents mistakenly got me Mega Man 2, which is a common parent thing, right? You ask them for
right.
something, and they give you sort of a different kind of similar version of it. But I actually turned out to be for the better, because I don't really like Mega Man 1 all that much, and I played Mega Man 2 probably every day for 2 or 3 years. I just love the game that much.
Which one was it that introduced the dog?
That would be Mega Man 3. That's a Rush, the dog. Which is also a good Mega Man. Probably the second best Mega Man, again, in my opinion.
Like I said, it's like they all kind of blur together to me. But I played all of them. I mean, those were ones where I had a lot of friends who had Nintendo systems, and we would trade cartridges. You know, hey, I'll give you my Karnov. Give
right,
me your
exactly.
Super Mario 2 for the week.
So any games on the system, on this list of games, stick out to you?
There are ones that I really wish were on here that are not, but a couple ones that do stick out are Metroid, which was also kind of a game changer a little bit. Obviously, Mario Brother games are a no-brainer. If you look at the list, I think probably half of these are Nintendo games anyway,
sure.
So there weren't really any licensing issues. But as far as anything that sticks out, there are a couple where I understand why they're on there, but it's like, is it really necessary, like Balloon Fight, the Donkey Kongs. Why are those there? And I understand they're classic games, and don't get me wrong, they're enjoyable to play. But when you look at the massive catalog of what is out there or what was out there, it seems like these were ones that they did because they didn't cost them anything. There are much better games that they could have. There's ones that they didn't include on here, which are good, because some of the original Nintendo either release titles or close to release titles were pretty terrible. And they don't have any really terrible games on here, but there's a couple ones where it's like, I could live without this one, or I could live without that one.
Sure.
You know, obviously said the Mario Brothers one, Legend of Zelda is one that I think that it wouldn't be excusable if that one wasn't there. I could live without the Legend of Zelda 2.
You're going to get hate
mail. That's fine. I don't have a problem with that. It's one of my favorite games. A game that made me buy the Super Nintendo was Link to the Past. One of my favorite games. Love that game. Zelda and Link to the Past, I would say, are very, very close as far as what they do, how they play. You know, Zelda 2, The Adventure of Link, it almost feels like a different game, much the same way like Super Mario 2 was originally not a Super Mario game. It was a game that already existed that they reskinned to bring into the Mario system. And I love Super Mario 2. I remember playing that in college, and I left it on overnight because I got to the end with the sleeping Mario, and I had to show my roommate that, I'd actually beat this thing, because there was no battery backup. There was no saves. I had no cheat codes. I had beat that game myself. But for me, you said, you know, Mega Man 2 is one of your favorite games. My favorite game of all time isn't on this system. My favorite game of all time, which I think I mentioned last time, is Mario 64. For the NES, and I understand why it's not there, but probably my favorite game for the NES was Double Dribble.
Double Dribble!
I loved that game. I mean,
I played a lot of that game, too.
Yeah, and we used to play that game nonstop. And it was a thing where if you were playing against a computer, you got to be so good that you couldn't not beat the computer. And for me, I would play Level 3 Chicago against New York. And for me to win the game, I had to score 240 points in 10-minute quarters and give up less than 20 points to the computer. That was kind of the metric, the way that I played. I love that game. That game and Blades of Steel, not as popular, but another Konami sports title that was, I thought, really, really good. And like I said, those are probably licensing issues. There are a couple other ones that are missing. We talked earlier about Battletoads.
Yeah, Battletoads is not on here. And that one, I bet it's probably a licensing issue. Double Dragon 2 is on here, not Double Dragon, which is another game in the same vein, the beat 'em up there. But Battletoads was, I guess it was Rare, but it was something that Nintendo, I think, maybe co-licensed or co-developed or something. Mm-hmm. There might be a licensing problem with that, and that's why it's not on the system. But that notoriously difficult game, Battletoads.
Yeah.
Pretty graphically advanced game for Nintendo as well. It was late in the Nintendo's life cycle, and the developers had picked up a lot of tricks, a lot of parallax type things, and it's a technically impressive game, very difficult, and relatively famous.
Yeah, I also would have liked to seen River City Ransom on here.
Yeah, another game in that same sort of beat-em-up genre, but a little more of an RPG as well. It's a big world map, you go around, you can get items and things like that.
Yeah, definitely a different one, and one of those ones that you either had to get lucky or know someone or call the Nintendo tip line in order to figure out how to get out of the gym.
Which, by the way, I think I don't know if it's still open, but they said they were going to open the Nintendo hotline for one day to promote this release of the NES Classic. Did you read anything about that?
I don't remember reading that, but I read so much that I forget more than I remember.
I thought that was a fun idea. One thing on this system is Punch-Out. Punch-Out has a bit of an interesting license history. Most people know it as Mike Tyson's Punch-Out, even though most of the Punch-Out releases throughout Nintendo's history, the sequels and the arcade games and whatnot, did not feature Mike Tyson. This one is Punch-Out featuring Mr. Dream.
You know, obviously, there was reasons why that happened. I don't believe, and I could be completely wrong about this, but I don't believe that this was a licensing issue. This was a PR issue because of who Mike Tyson was, what Mike Tyson did. Nintendo, especially back then, was very, very protective about their family image. And famously with to switch systems, like on the Super Nintendo, there was an issue with Mortal Kombat on the Super Nintendo because you were not allowed to have blood in Nintendo games. You know, with Mike Tyson, I think that enough time has passed. He's paid his debt to society. He's had several TV shows since then that he's a goofy guy. You know, he has his appearances in the Hangover films. I think that this is one of a couple missteps that Nintendo probably did. I think that honestly, having it be Punch-Out with Mike Tyson would have been more appealing to the nostalgic gamer than Punch-Out with Mr. Dream.
The story is that Nintendo, I mean, Punch-Out is a game that Nintendo had in arcades. It's a very unique game.
Sitting right next to it.
Yeah, he has one right in his home arcade. Very, very unique game, very unique history about how it was made and why it was made. Never really caught on as much in Japan as it did in the United States. Nintendo decided to license Mike Tyson's likeness for the U.S. version of Punch-Out. And they signed a 3-year licensing deal with him. So during that time, they were printing Mike Tyson's Punch-Out. Around that time, within that 3 years, was the whole Mike Tyson rape trial and all that stuff. Maybe for that reason, or maybe just because they didn't want to pay the money again, they did not re-sign him to the license. And so, if they wanted to re-release Mike Tyson's Punch-Out, they would probably have to sign Mike Tyson again. They might be willing to do, but it might cost more than they're willing to pay.
I didn't know that, so that's actually very informative. But I can imagine that you have to do the cost-benefit ratio there. And I think that he's not nearly as expensive as he was then. And number two, you're
probably right.
And this is a thing that doesn't really need advertising. It doesn't. It's going to sell no matter what. It's a guaranteed seller. But having him be part of that package, I think, makes it more appealing. That's just my opinion.
As far as I know, there's no SD card slot to load up Mike Tyson's Punch-Out in the system, and there probably never will be. There will probably be future versions of this system. I'm guessing on an annual basis, as Nintendo is wont to do, reselling you the same game over and over again, which seems to be successful for them, don't get me wrong, but they're going to release another version, I'm sure, with more games in future years, and probably a Super Nintendo is down the road after that, and so on, until basically they're just selling the same 10 games over and over every year, and making a fortune.
Yeah, and I think that is one of the things where... And this is one way that Nintendo reminds me of Apple, in that Nintendo has gotten so much right with the way the system is designed, but for all these things that they did, in my mind, things exactly how they should be done, down to the fact that the shell of the unit looks like a mini NES.
Right.
The fact that it doesn't have a network connection, I think, very short-sighted, because it would not have been very difficult for them to, even without an SD slot, just have soldered in expandable storage. And the entire NES library can probably fit on a 2-gig SD card. It's not a cost issue. And if they had added a network jack and added a store where people could log in and download
a virtual console, perhaps.
Exactly, just like the virtual console, it would have been something that I think would have been a great idea. That's one of the things that I think they got wrong. The fact that the cables for the controllers are extremely short.
This is what I've heard. This is one of the complaints, is that, you know, in the old days, you could sit right in front of your TV and play with a corded NES controller, and it was no big deal. But these days, we expect our controllers to be wireless and our couches across the room from our 60-inch TV, and a 3-foot cord is just not going to cut it.
Right, and you can buy third-party extenders, and they work fine. That's not the problem, but I just think it's extremely short-sighted. I can understand why they didn't go the wireless route, just because it does add cost to them to do it that way. It's something where it makes the system much more difficult to use. And I believe also if you plug in a classic controller from the Wii system, it actually has the home button on the controller itself, right, which will take you back to the main menu. Okay. The controllers that are included, or if you buy one of the ones that are designed specifically for the system, do not have the ability to do that. So you right, actually have to go up and, I believe, press the reset button to take you back to the main screen. And that's just something that they didn't add either for aesthetic reasons or they just opted not to, but it's another miss that they have there.
And one thing we didn't mention was that you can actually save state with the NES Classic. So if you're playing and you want to just sort of pause the game, save your game right where you are and come back and play later, you can. For instance, if you're playing Battletoads, that's going to come in real handy.
Ninja Gaiden, I don't know how it's pronounced, the last level is so incredibly hard that would be something that would come in handy. I believe Excitabike that is on there is probably the same one that was on the cartridge version. You know, if you want to create your own tracks, you won't have to worry about putting in that super long code. It's just going to work on Punch Out. You can just go back to where you were rather than worrying about the code, even though I'm sure a lot of us actually probably remember the codes at the time to get to Tyson. There are a lot of things that are really great about this system, but there's also a lot of things that are questionable decisions that make it not as easy to put it in the, yeah, I got to have this column.
One thing that I found kind of strange was this system does have Super C on it, which is the sequel to Contra, but doesn't have the original Contra. And my thought is that if they can get licensing for Super Contra, why not the original one? Because that's what people are nostalgic for. They know the cheat code for that, like you mentioned. And they're going to sell more controllers because it's a two-player game. So it makes me think that maybe they're even holding back specifically for another release. Like, oh, it's the new one, and this one has Contra on it.
There has to be a reason for that one specifically. I think for almost every other one, like Double Dragon 2, I think that Double Dragon 2 is actually a better game than Double Dragon was. So that's part of it. But I think that with Super C, there has to be a legitimate reason why it's that one and not Contra, because Contra is going to be the one that is going to be the bigger draw.
Yeah, I can't believe it would be a technical reason or a licensing reason because they have Super C. So my only conclusion I can draw is that they're holding it back on purpose, but maybe that's just me being paranoid. So for $60, or maybe 70 if you buy a second controller, is this one, you've kind of alluded to this, would you recommend picking this one up as a gift maybe, or even just for yourself?
Well, I'm going to get it. I mean, it's me. So, I mean, I'm almost embarrassed to say that, but I mean, it's going to happen. As far as recommending it, I would say borrow somebody's, play for it with a weekend, see if you're going to actually get the replayability out of it. One of the things that is very, very nice about this system, even compared to like the virtual console versions, either on the Wii or the Wii U, is you have never seen these games look this good before. You could say it's because it's an HDMI connector, but that doesn't hold water because the Wii U has an HDMI connector. There's something to do with the way that the video output is set up on this unit that everything is super crystal clear. You can actually adjust it. You can actually add scan lines or fake scan lines. These games will never have looked this good, assuming you don't have a Retron 5 or another console like that. So for that alone, if you can look at this and you can find, you know, 10 of your favorite games, there it's probably worth it. I would say for someone that's on the fence about it, look at the list. Can you come up with 10, 15 games that, hey, these are ones I'm going to want to spend some time with. This is a way that I want to revisit my past. If so, yes. If not, there's probably better ways to spend your $60 and get the equivalent of the same thing.
You've actually played one. I have not played one yet, but I think I would recommend it just based on the aesthetics alone. I mean, like you said, the system looks like a mini NES. The controllers are period replicas of the original NES controllers, and it comes with a pretty good selection of games. There are a few weak ones like Balloon Fight and the original, not Super Mario Brothers, but Mario Brothers, which are games that you're basically not going to play. But for the most part, this is a pretty good library of games, and I think I would certainly recommend anyone listening to buy me one for Christmas.
Yeah, if you want to buy me one, that's a no-brainer.
So, we've talked a lot about these two systems. I think we both like them. We're both total retro nerds, but let us know. Leave a comment on this episode. Tell us what you think, or if you have any recommendations for other systems we talk about in the future episode. Anything you'd like to mention or plug before we go, Mr. Bach?
No, I want everybody to have a safe and happy holiday, whatever holidays you choose to celebrate. And if you want to send me presents, contact Matt and he can get you my address and send me stuff. So
my guest today has been Matt Bach. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
This has been the Cross-Cutting Concerns podcast, produced and recorded by Matt Groves 2016. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it on social media and leave a review on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you downloaded this podcast. For show notes, please go to crosscuttingconcerns.com. This episode is recorded under the Creative Commons Attribution 4.0 license. The hosting for this podcast was made possible in part by Microsoft. It was recorded and mixed with the help of Skype, Audacity, and Camtasia Recorder. The theme music is by the Dirty Truckers. You can buy their music on Amazon or iTunes. If you or someone you know would like to be a guest on a future episode, please go to crosscuttingconcerns.com and submit your name and idea. Bumble.